I'd like to welcome everyone to the Minnesota Groundwater Association 2019 Spring Conference. For those of you that don't know me, I'm Kate Pound, current president of MGWA. So, before we introduce today's program, there's a few logistical items. As I mentioned, we are completely booked out, so no empty seats. Now, we do have a full day today. In order to keep on schedule, I'll do my best to cut off speakers at their allotted time. So if you don't have enough time for questions, I just encourage you to discuss things during break time. In addition to our speakers, we have a robust collection of posters. The poster room is just across the hall and up the stairs. So I do encourage everyone to go and visit the posters during our breaks. I also want to say a really big thank you to our commercial exhibitors, Geoprobe, Thine, thank you, and RNAS Remediation. You're supporting student attendance at this conference. I also want to welcome our nonprofit exhibitor, the Minnesota chapter of AWG. That's the Association for Women Geoscientists. So please do visit with all of our exhibitors. We will be providing mentoring and discussion for students, early career professionals, and new to Minnesota individuals during and over the lunch period. I'll give more instruction on that immediately prior to lunch. So finally, if you've taken a look at the schedule for today, one thing you will have noticed is that one of our invited speakers, Ken Bradbury, director of the Wisconsin Geological and Natural History Survey, wasn't able to make it and had to cancel. This means we will be finishing closer to 4:30. So, moving straight into our topic for today, it's time to talk about till, glacial sediments and groundwater. What was my rationale for selecting this theme? Nearly all of us, whether we focus on surficial sediment or bedrock, or encounter material that has previously been mapped as till, or somehow fits the description of what we consider a till to be, deal with glacial sediment. Many of us, whether it's from consulting, management, modeling, or teaching, have to consider the movement of water through till and its implications. And as you all know, over the past 25 years, surficial geologists have made enormous advances in their understanding of processes associated with till deposition and the complexity of till stratigraphy in the upper Midwest. And at the same time, there have been a number of evolving research projects that have investigated groundwater conductivity and tills. So the topic is ripe for review. That said, we will now all be able to say we have attended a G2 summit, glacial sediment and groundwater. So with no further ado, I want to introduce our first speaker, Jason Muckle, from the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, where he is Section Manager for Inventory, Monitoring, and Analysis. Jason has a BS from San Jose State University, a Master's and PhD from the University of Montana. Jason will provide us with an overview of the role that groundwater models play in ecology and management, with a view of how till may play into that, I believe. So thank you. Jason, it's all yours.
Good morning. I rarely ever get nervous speaking anymore, but when I'm up here in front of a bunch of geologists and I can't claim to know very much at all about geology, it is a bit intimidating. Kate called several months back, I guess, and said she was looking for me to be a speaker on this topic, and it was about till. And I said, I don't know anything about till. I'm not a geologist. I think you want somebody from this or that. And as we talked more, what I came to understand is that she was really looking for sort of a policy setting to frame, I think, a lot of the conversation and the details about the geology that you all will be hearing about throughout the day. So in the end, I think we agreed that maybe I had something to offer. But I'm also mindful that I think I've been in front of this group twice over the last half a dozen years. The most recent time was a joint presentation with Glenn Champion, one of our groundwater modelers at DNR, and Ian Chisholm, one of our stream ecologists at DNR, and we were talking about some work that we were doing, and in particular, we were talking about Little Rock Creek and how we were applying an understanding of a groundwater model and stream ecology to the challenges of managing groundwater appropriation permits in Little Rock Creek. We've also had this little thing called White Bear Lake and a lawsuit going on. You might have seen this in the news on Monday. There was another twist and turn in the legal battle. So what I'm going to do is update a little bit where we've been at and try to just talk about this more in the sense of what we're doing at DNR and how we're trying to integrate and intersect, as the topic of the day, the notion of geology, the hydrology, the ecology, and state statutes, and then we throw in these things like lawsuits. All of my DNR colleagues, I think, have heard me or versions of some of this before, so apologies for them. And hopefully this isn't all repeat, but some new information for you all. I'm going to go through it very quickly because I think there may be several questions, and I'm going to try to leave a considerable amount of time at the end. So with that, I will start. The state policy, simply, if you want to think about it, in the direction for the DNR is that we are to develop and use water with the caveat sustainably. So what does that mean? So we'll talk about that. Our approach at the DNR is to vigorously pursue the science with the county geologic atlases, water level data, ecology, hydrology, understanding of wetlands, all of these things, to vigorously pursue the science in specific locations to understand the dynamics of what's happening. And so as I think about telling the things that I've learned from the staff that work at DNR, we're learning a lot about the leakiness of till and how that needs to be factored into our analyses. We're also working with stakeholders and building relationships. And you have to sit next to other people when you do that. It's challenging. It takes time. And things that we've been experiencing is the difficulty of building trust. People just generally don't want to trust people who have a role in regulation and telling them no or how much or how little. And that's part of what we've been experiencing, and I'll talk a little bit about that. So I'm going to illustrate this approach through primarily about three geographic areas. I'll talk about White Bear Lake fairly quickly. I'm going to talk about Little Rock Creek, and then I'm going to talk about Bonanza Valley and maybe lean in on a few other areas where we'll be working. So our responsibility, as laid out in statute, is to assure supply, develop and manage, and I've highlighted in bold all of the uses that we have to balance in any given place, domestic, municipal, industrial, not so bad, agriculture. Well, then we have fish and wildlife. Then we have recreation, power, navigation. So I've been calling this the have your cake and eat it too responsibility. It seems to me that when you look at a lot of the statutes that we have, there was a recognition or a lack of recognition that water might in fact be limited in some places to do all of these things. And that somewhere along the line we'd have to say no. For many, many years, it seems like the state of Minnesota mostly was expecting yes, 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 yes. And I think for the most part we were yes, 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 yes. But we're now confronted with, well, maybe, maybe not, and no. And that's the challenge. And as you can appreciate, when you tell somebody no, what they want to know specifically is exactly why not. Show me the proof. Oh, well, so what if that calcareous fen loses a little bit of head? Is that a really big deal? Well, I don't know. Let's go out and lose a few, and then we can actually prove it to you that, you know, yes, it is a big deal. So it's difficult. You get to this point of, do you have to lose a resource in order to be able to save other resources, to be able to figure out those thresholds? And I think we've been making some good headway. This is no mystery to you all, but the way I try to talk about this with other organizations and other stakeholders, like yesterday at a Sensible Land Use Coalition, and I was in a room with developers and city administrators, and they're all talking about what drives development patterns, and it was all about the return on their investment and what they could rent the properties for. Never once did anybody mention water. So we're talking about managing an invisible resource, which is also part of the challenge. Okay, so I've talked about the stakeholders. We've got the private well owners. We've got the community water supplies. Obviously, various forms of industry. And in rural Minnesota, our agricultural economy is changing. Many parts of rural Minnesota is looking to diversify its economy. And some of the ways that they're looking to diversify actually involve water, which is a challenge in some parts, particularly in southwestern Minnesota. Irrigation is expanding. We've seen that going on, the pattern, for a number of years. We're at a little over 3% of agricultural land being irrigated. It is now a form of crop insurance. It's a way to assure yield. And in the agricultural economy, the way it is now, having a decline in yield even 1 year can be make or break for some of these producers. So we can understand why they are so vigorously pursuing it. But we also have these natural resources. We have trout streams. We have all kinds of surface water features on the landscape that are connected to our groundwater in various ways, including wetlands. So for the North and East Metro, we developed a plan. Several of the people in this room contributed to development of that plan. That was in 2015. And it followed what we've identified as our 7 core strategies for groundwater management. This isn't new, but I think it's worth just revisiting, because sometimes you write a plan and you think the plan goes up on the shelf, you don't use it. I'm really happy to say that we are applying the plan that we developed in 2013 on a daily basis within the DNR. I can't honestly say that in my 20 years at DNR, there's ever been a plan that I've experienced that is being used and applied on a daily basis the way this plan is. Heightening the priority given to groundwater. Absolutely. We've been doing that, and we continue to do that. We're enhancing the information that's available for decisions. We are improving our management of permits. We've got an online system. We've got a much more rigorous review. We actually have people that have the technical skills to review these permits. Oops, hit the wrong one. We are improving compliance. We had a significant effort a number of years ago to go out and identify all the crop circles that didn't seem to have a permit associated with them. And we found a few. Improving communication and education. Our website continues to get better. We are continuing to interact in other forums. I mentioned the Sensible Land Use one yesterday, just talking about water and water supply. You know, we're doing this in partnership with a lot of people. There's all kinds of efforts because of the Clean Water Legacy Fund to increase Minnesotans' awareness of water, water quality, and the challenges that we face. Effectively address the challenges in areas of high use. So we recognized that we needed to focus on the areas where the water use was increasing the most or had increased the most. And those became our groundwater management areas, and as well now Little Rock Creek, Cold Spring, another area of the state where we're working, and then we've got a few more. And then promoting water conservation and wise use practices. We have a statewide database, thanks to Carmelita Nelson, one of the people that work at DNR and an outside contractor. They've developed a open database, and cities across the state are now putting information in about water use and their efforts to conserve water. And the way they do this, they can see what other communities are doing and what's working. So I tried a toilet replacement plan, and here's how many gallons we saved. I tried this, and here's how many gallons we saved. We've implemented this, and so forth, information sharing. And it's also a way for us as a state to see how we're doing and what's working. Big cities started. We're going to the small cities this year, I believe, and then we're going to agricultural irrigation next with this tool. So progress. Complex groundwater models is really, and this is a simple version, of what we're really trying to bring to these high-use, intense-use areas. Complex geology, complex water movement, interactions with surface water resources and ecosystems, which alone are extremely complex. So I think everybody in this room understands that, and my understanding of modeling is basically to try to put numbers on everything numerically and figure out how much water are we pulling away from a resource, how is it affecting other resources and other people. Okay, so let's talk about White Bear Lake. So I won't go through the entire history of White Bear Lake. It's somewhat boring. I'll just at least if you feel like you've lived it every day for 5-6 years. In 2017, District Judge Marinan decided in favor of the plaintiffs and said, basically, DNR, you can't issue any more permits within 5 miles of White Bear Lake, and you need to do a determination of whether or not the existing use is sustainable. And if the lake gets below 923.5, you have to implement a 5 mile wide circumference around the lake community residential irrigation ban, and there was a few other things. At the time, we were actively working to build off of a steady state groundwater model that the USGS had developed. We wanted a transient groundwater model that would tell us more of the seasonality of things going on with White Bear Lake. And we went to trial. We didn't have the model complete. Trial finished. We got the model complete late that year. And then the judge's orders came out, and then we said, okay, well, what do we learn from all this? So we did our analysis, and I'm going to show you what the analysis has shown and what our conclusions are, and I'm going to tie that back to policy of the state. So one of the premises of the lawsuit was that groundwater use within 5 miles of White Bear Lake had been increasing. The graph shows otherwise. That's the trend. Significant factor in that, worth noting, is that St. Paul Regional Water Services, if you don't know, if you're not from the cities, relies primarily on the Mississippi River, but they have historically used a fair amount of groundwater for blending and taste and temperature and all these things. Their water treatment system of the Mississippi has gotten better thanks to their investments. Therefore, they no longer need to rely on groundwater. They will use it as an emergency backup, but they're not relying on it. So their use of groundwater is going down. In our analysis, we looked at it and we said, okay, well, if they're not using it, let's use it as zero in our analysis. The long-term record of White Bear Lake is variable. You can go back to the Dust Bowl, and it was pretty dry. It was pretty low. It rebounded after periods of heavy and above normal rain. There were changes in the outlet. That's reflected in that dark dashed line at the top. So water was flowing out of White Bear Lake at lower and lower elevations over time. Plays a role, which we didn't have a way of fully understanding until very recently. I've got the purple line on there. That's the solid one at 922. That's the elevation that we at DNR set as what we call a protective elevation. And the way that we arrived at that is that we looked at every bit of information that we could relative to the lake's ecosystem, so fish and wildlife habitat. We looked at water quality. We looked at the long-term period of record. We looked at recreational uses. We looked at dock lengths. We looked at Eurasian water milfoil treatment permits. We looked at shoreline fishing. We looked at dock lengths. And in the end, we concluded that ecologically, White Bear Lake, like most lakes in the state, fluctuate and benefit from sometimes going lower and then coming back up. And the main reason is that the emergent aquatic vegetation gets stimulated to regenerate when water levels go low. And lots of wildlife, waterfowl, and small fish use that emergent vegetation as an important part of their life cycle. But the recreational impacts become greater and greater as the water levels go lower. So we landed on 922 as the point where the recreational impacts get to be fairly significant when you go below that. Above that, they're there, but there's also ecological benefits. The ecological benefits diminish when you go below 922. So going lower than that doesn't add a whole lot of value from an ecological perspective. So this is how we're trying to figure out the balance of the ecosystem part with the water part. And then the groundwater model helped us understand what role did pumping play in the lake levels that we were seeing. And on this graph, what we're showing is the simulation of the triennial groundwater model. It's so four-month increments. The green line represents the model's prediction of what water levels would have been for the last 15 years had there been no groundwater pumping within the 5 miles. The black line represents the worst case if everybody pumped at their absolute maximum authorized volume every single year during that period of time, what the lake level would have been. Blue represents the actual, what we saw. And then orange represents our analysis of the existing use. So that bar chart that showed water use going down over time, we took the last 10 years and said, that represents the existing use for these communities within 5 miles. What would lake levels look like if that had been in place for the last 30 years, since 1988? That's what the orange line represents. And then we wanted to know the judge's irrigation ban, what would that effect be? And that represents the dark brown on top of the orange. And essentially what it showed is that temporarily shutting off residential irrigation within 5 miles wasn't going to have a meaningful effect on White Bear Lake. Usually I get a lot of puzzled looks as why. So part of it is that the cities that are closest to White Bear Lake are having the biggest effect on White Bear Lake, but those are cities that are mature. Their landscaping is developed. There's lots of trees. They don't use as much water on lawns as newly developing suburbs do, which tend to be farther away from White Bear Lake. Well, it takes a lot longer for a reduction in water use 4 and 5 miles away from White Bear Lake to reach the lake than it does the ones closest. This was also a residential irrigation ban. It was a complete outdoor irrigation ban. It's just residential. So bottom line is what we found is that we don't think that this is an effective management tool. If the lake is low, we just stop watering lawns. So we don't think it's going to end up making much of a difference. That's not the same as saying a 25% reduction in water use across the area every year, year after year, wouldn't make a difference. It would, absolutely. But the residential irrigation ban would not. Okay, I'm going to pause for a second. I want to just, this is a nice little video we put together.
It's no secret that lakes are the pride of Minnesota. They're stitched into the very fabric of our identity. We revel in the breathtaking scenery of our lakes. We play, relax, and build communities alongside their sky blue waters. Lakes are so much more than bodies of water surrounded by land. Just like forests or prairies, they are complex and dynamic ecosystems, an underwater world teeming with life and character. A dynamic ecosystem is one that changes. One way to tell that a lake changes is by its water level. The shoreline doesn't always stay in the same spot. It might seem like a bad thing when the water levels of a lake are low, but in reality, changing water levels are the mark of a healthy, normal lake. If we look under the surface, we can see a whole forest of aquatic plants and animals. One such plant is the three-square bulrush. This reed creates a habitat for fish and insects both in and out of the water. It protects the shoreline from wave-action erosion. But bulrush seeds can't germinate underwater. They need moist soil and sunshine. Since they can't walk, they have to wait, sometimes for years, until the exposed lake bed comes to them. Without changes in water level, the three-square bulrush can't grow, and an essential part of our healthy lakes would be lost. While a lake reed may seem about as exciting as lawn grass, it's just one small part of a world where plants and animals of all shapes and sizes call home. Lakes are more than giant puddles. They're an ever-changing ecosystem. A thriving example of nature's wondrous beauty and the pride of Minnesotans. As we step in to manage our lakes, we need to balance our actions with nature's patterns, and our lakes will continue to be the pride of Minnesota for generations to come.
So I want to go back and just make one point that I didn't when I was on this graph, and that is that clearly pumping makes a difference in White Bear Lake. We know that. Now we have a tool to help us understand how to manage it. And then the question is, what's the ideal lake level? So I talked about working with communicating and stakeholders. That video was our attempt to help people to start to appreciate that having the lake always be in the same exact spot year after year after year after year is not necessarily good for the lake. And I recently said, you know, one of the things I think that I regret when we were testifying in front of the judge is that we did not help her understand that we have not harmed White Bear Lake. White Bear Lake's ecology is just fine. And this is, Dale and I were talking about this, about judges and science. So the challenges that we have. Okay, I got to move along more quickly. Our summary here is that the existing use does not harm the ecosystem of White Bear Lake. It's not violating safe yield. The water levels in the aquifer are just fine. Yes, they fluctuate, but they're not anywhere close to the top of the aquifer. We're not degrading water quality, but water levels are going below the protective elevation. So the question is, what do we do going forward? What do these communities do? How do we look at alternatives to meeting water supply needs, as well as the future growth, right? Because this is just existing. We haven't even considered future growth, so there's work to be done there. All right. Little Rock Creek, it's a central part of the state. It's sandy soils. Glenn talked about this at a previous conference. I just put this up so you can see. Again, rigorous pursuit of the science. Lots and lots of monitoring, lots of assessment going on, water level gauges, observation wells, stream flow, etc. And then here's my ode to geology. The complexity of the glacial tills and the outwash, and how do you try to model that and have it all make sense? Okay, so our observation well network, the crew putting in some wells, nested wells, helping understand this relationship in the leakage and the tills, stream gauges, and fish. So going out, locating fish in the habitats that they're using at different water levels, and then figuring out how are they going to be affected and which species are going to be affected most if the water levels go lower during summer low flows, for example. That's what we're doing, including stream temperature analysis, and then Glenn is continuing to update the groundwater model that he's developed and is going to be incorporating some additional years of data. So far, what the model indicates is that we're having a pretty substantial effect on stream flow. Somewhere in the 20-plus percentage of the August median base flow is being pulled away from that stream in some years. Not every year, but in some years. But we're still trying to piece it all together. All right, Bonanza Valley is another area where we're working. Again, we've increased the amount of monitoring. I wanted to point out the importance of this, and it takes a long time for some of this data to become valuable, of course. But prior to 2009, we had a few discharge measurements, spot measurements at 15 different sites. Now in 2018, we have 7 continuous monitoring sites for stage, precip, and water temperature, and 2 climate stations. We had 25 observation wells. None of them had continuous monitoring. Now we have 56, all with continuous monitoring, and some appropriation wells. So we're getting a lot more data and information. I do want to point out that this is mostly courtesy of the Clean Water Land and Legacy Amendment. If we did not have these funds to do this work, we would not be getting the information. A lot of people don't want to put money into monitoring. They want to put it into implementation. So just as a note, in the future, if you're looking at a way to support DNR in this work, Clean Water Fund is an important one. This is the difference between the monthly discharge measure or monthly water level readings and the continuous. Obviously, we're getting a lot more information. All of this is available on the website. However, we still need a lot better data on hydrology. As much as we do have pretty good data on lake levels, we know very little about wetlands and the ecology of wetlands and how they're affected. This is a major gap for us, and it's significant in the Bonanza Valley. We've got a partnership with the Fish and Wildlife Service, and we're getting more information, but it's going to be a real limiting factor for us in that area. So other areas where we're doing this work, Cold Spring, I mentioned, it's another trout stream. We've got an important industry in town that's drawing water, and we think it's probably drawing more than the stream can tolerate and continue to be a trout stream. We anticipate developing a groundwater model in Dakota County. We're anxious to get the atlases updated so that we can do that with the best possible information. Southwestern Minnesota is a different kind of challenge. Lots of small aquifers, small communities. We have our Region 4 office is managing a thing they call CAMP, Community Aquifer Management Partnership, all about understanding what's going on and engaging stakeholders in conversation. And then we're also working really closely in the Rochester area. This is the Destination Medical Center, planned growth and increased use of water significantly. We've got some pretty rare resources, calcareous fens, trout streams, and other things down in that part of the state. And we have karst. I know we're not at a karst conference. It's had its day, but it's worth its mention. All right, so just in closing and hopefully a couple minutes for questions, we're using the science and data to inform our management planning. You know, all this stuff seems really simple, but it is really complex when you dig into it. I mean, I think you all appreciate that. And I can't overemphasize the importance of the engagement of stakeholders. The work doesn't get done behind a computer. It gets done in meeting rooms using the data and the analysis that we can bring from our computers. I will continue to say that as far as I can see when it comes to the quantity issues in Minnesota, we're mostly in the urgency room in some areas. We're not in the emergency room like some other parts of the country. We do need to continue to make this a priority and keep it in front of people, but we need to do it in a very thoughtful and deliberate way and take our time and get it right. Okay, we'll take some questions if we have a couple minutes, I think. Hopefully. Couple minutes, two.
So we can take some questions for Jason. Thank you for giving us this overview of the role of research, policy, and management. Questions for Jason.
I believe within the last few days I saw some newspaper reports that the feds are trying to make it a little more difficult to regulate groundwater that pops up into surface water. And I was curious if that's going to affect our regulation of the leaking taconite tailings ponds. I think quite a few of them are leaking into groundwater, and within a few hundred yards, it's surface water again. So is that an issue with the state?
I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with the story and the issue.
Oh, I think they're going to try to, if you're discharging into groundwater, they're going to make it a little more rigorous to actually prove that that's going over to surface water. Direct connection. They want to see a direct connection. And so I think what we got in northern Minnesota is perhaps direct connection, perhaps not in some places. But perhaps I saw it on some errant email and it didn't make the mainline news.
Okay. Sorry, I won't be able to answer that one for you. I don't want to speculate.